Good afternoon. This is the WILP Wake Up Call Connecting the Dots. My name is Dick Paddock, and I will be the co-host today, also trying to run the board without falling off of it. And my co-host today is Tana Hartman. We plan to have a very special guest. If he manages to make the call in from wherever he is in Atlanta. His name is Howie Hawkins, and he's a founding member of the Clamshell Alliance and also a founding member of the U.S. Green Party. And he's going to talk to us about what we at WILP, among others, are sponsoring called the No Nukes Tour, which is an attempt to bring to people who otherwise don't know about it the problems associated with having nuclear power, which is which they're trying to expand in this area, but which has not been a possibility for over 30 years, thanks to the efforts of Howie Hawkins and a lot of other people who have held the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the myriad of nuclear power advocates and companies like GE and Westinghouse to keep things trying to keep things boiling in their water. So far, I haven't seen the call from Howie. Tana, do you have any comments?
No, I just want to say we'll be talking a bit today about back in 2007, there was a book published. It was a joint project of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute and the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. And it's available online. In fact, you can download it for free at www.ieer.org/carbon-free. The title of the book and project is Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. And we'll talk more about that later. So it looks like our guest is calling in.
Howie, is that you?
Well, it's Teresa. I just wanted to say that if we could keep the interview to about 20 minutes, that would be great.
Okay, sure.
Oh, okay, so let me let you talk to Howie so you can check the sound level.
Okay, Teresa, thanks. Go ahead, Howie.
Hello.
Let me crank it up just a little bit. Okay, go ahead.
How does that sound?
That sounds good.
Okay.
So we're all set.
Right.
It sounds a little low to me.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Try it some more. Try again, Howie.
My name's Howie Hawkins.
That's better.
Yeah, we're good. Okay. This is Dick Paddock, and I have my co-host, Tana Hartman, here with me. And we'd like to find out, we know a lot about what you've been doing so far, but if you could give us just a little background sketch as to why you're on the tour, and what you've done so far, including your experiences this afternoon.
Well, first, let's tell us the name of the tour and where you're going.
Okay.
Well, it's the No Nukes Tour, and it's organized by the Southern Anti-Racism Network and co-sponsored with the Blue Ridge Environmental Defense Fund, Green Parties in Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, South Carolina Progressive Network, Georgia Women's Action for New Directions, and we met with the Columbia Central Labor Council last night, so a lot of groups. And what we're doing is we started in Raleigh, North Carolina, and had a news conference in front of the old State House about the tour, and then moved on to an evening event at the Myers Park Baptist Church in Charlotte. And then the next day, on Tuesday, we were at the University of South Carolina. And as I mentioned, at the Columbia AFL-CIO Central Labor Council. Today, this morning, we were at Payne College in Augusta. And we just got out of a meeting with the NRC Region 2 office, where we talked to the people that regulate and monitor the nuclear power plants. And tonight we'll be in Columbus meeting with community activists there. And then tomorrow is a meeting as part of the No Nukes Tour with Georgia Women's Action for New Directions in Atlanta. And then on Friday we wind up in Gainesville in Florida with a meeting at the Friends Meeting House with anti-nuclear and green activists there. So that's the tour. And we're doing it in the South because this is where the industry thinks they can revive nuclear power industry, which is a dead industry. It's been economically bankrupt. It can't operate profitably without massive government subsidies. And, of course, we've had the worst industrial accidents in history at Chernobyl and now Fukushima. And, you know, just to underscore that, there's now a study out by the New York Academy of Sciences compiling and translating the Slavic language scientific studies of the impact of that disaster at Chernobyl. And they've documented 973,000 deaths so far, premature deaths, mainly due to cancer and other diseases from radiation. Call it a million deaths from one accident. And Fukushima is probably going to release more radiation. There's more reactors, there's more radiation, and that's an ongoing disaster. So we're dealing with an industry that's an assault on the health and wealth of our communities. And because the industry thinks they can roll it over in the South, we're down here to organize the South.
Why do they think they can roll it over the South?
I think they figure it's a more favorable political climate. The people are not organized to resist when they find out what it does. And so it seems like politically it's easier to do it here than any other part of the country. That's what the industry thinks. But the South has, you know, from the civil rights movement on, shown that the people can rise up and do what's right. So,
yeah.
You know, we think the South can stop the nuclear industry here, and for good reason. As I mentioned, economically, it's a disaster. And you're getting in South Carolina, and they're proposing in Georgia, where the first plant, new plants are actually close to being at the construction phase. They're trying to impose what is called construction works in progress, which means you pay for the plant before it's even up and operating and you know it works.
Yeah.
Normally, in utility financing, the plant has to be built, and then it's put in the rate base, and the regulators give them a fair rate of return. So instead of, see, Wall Street will not invest in nuclear power. It's too risky. The insurance companies won't insure it, so the government insures it and limits the liability. So the maximum damage from a nuclear disaster they'll pay for any one accident is $9 billion, which doesn't come close to the kind of damage that an accident like Fukushima is causing. So this thing cannot operate without subsidies, and now they want the ratepayers to pay up front for it because the investors won't invest in it without government guarantees on the loans. So all that is part of the economics of this, which are not good for the people.
What about the social climate? How does that contribute to the...
Well, unfortunately, a lot of waste dumps and nuclear power plants are cited, particularly in black communities. We were today talking with people who are from Berks County, where the Vogtle plant is in Georgia. And they already have two plants. And anecdotally, we're talking to a minister down there, Willie Tomlin, who says, you know, a lot of people are dying of cancer in that community close to the plant. And they're very concerned that a third plant is close to being constructed there. And they don't have the health of the people being monitored, so you don't have what's called epidemiological studies, so you can compare rates of cancer before the plants went in to after. And so they're all very concerned about that. And the thing is, they feel that the black communities have less political power, less influence, so that they can put it in those communities. So that's a big concern. And it's called environmental racism, and it's for real.
It's for real. Yes.
Yes.
We see it up here, too.
Yeah, there's a community up here in the Triangle called New Hill that's in the shadow of the Sharon Harris nuclear plant here. So we know exactly what you're talking about. It's in this neighborhood, too. So can you tell us anything about the meeting you had this afternoon with the NRC?
That's the National Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
And that's
Well, Region 2 has certain responsibilities for the nuclear power plants in the region. And I didn't bring my notes with me, but they have, as I recall, responsibility for 18 nuclear power sites in the South, which covers 31 or 32 or 33 nuclear power plants. But in addition to that, they are responsible for some things nationally, like fuel reprocessing, which is an effort to take spent fuel and reprocess it into nuclear fuel. See, when the fuel rods come out of a conventional reactor, they're more radioactive than they went in, but they can't continue the reactions that will heat the water, so they're put into storage. But if you take them and reprocess them, cut them up, and go through this whole industrial process, you can manufacture new rods. And every time they try to do that, it creates a lot of spillage and waste and dirty pollution from the radiation outside these reprocessing facilities. Like, I'm from New York. There was a reprocessing facility at a place called West Valley, and that was closed down decades ago, and they're still trying to figure out how to clean it up. Same problem in Hanford, Washington. Anyway, Region 2 Nuclear Office also regulates that, and they regulate the construction going on. They have the on-site construction inspectors. So they have a range of responsibilities in addition to just their regional responsibilities. In fact, two of their staff are over in Japan helping with attempting to stop the Fukushima disaster, which is still going on. So they explained their responsibilities, and we expressed our concerns. And look, the NRC staff, they're civil service, they're not political, and we want them to do a good job. Even if we're able to stop all nuclear power, they're going to have to monitor decommissioned nuclear power plant sites and waste, which is going to be around for hundreds of thousands of years. So this is an agency we want to work, and unfortunately Congress has underfunded them. So we were talking about these epidemiological studies, and they said, you know, we don't have the money to do them because Congress has decided they don't want to fund that part of nuclear regulation and monitoring. So this was an opportunity to, you know, build a relationship. Teresa Alamine, who organized this tour and is with the Southern Anti-Racism Network, always talking about building relationships. That's what organizing is about. So we were there to build a relationship with the regulators, who we want to do a good job because there are operating nuclear power plants, and God forbid we don't want a Fukushima-type disaster here. So we were there to express our concerns. They were there to tell us what they do and explain more about what they do. And so I think it was a productive meeting for all concerned.
I just have a question. I was looking over again. I had cause to look at it a couple of years ago, but just looking over it again, the report by Arjun Makajani from 2007 that was for the Nuclear Policy Research Institute and the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. How well respected, I mean, how do the folks at the NRC and other places like that, do they pay attention to the findings of that report? Because that report found that, you know, a zero CO2 economy not only could be achieved without resorting to nuclear power, but it's absolutely necessary. And it seemed to me a really compelling, their findings were really compelling. The research seemed to be stellar, but it kind of lay, I don't know, unheard.
Dormant.
Well, yeah, that book is called Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, or at least that's part of the title.
Yeah.
And actually, one of our delegation brought a copy of that to give to Teresa Alamine, so she now has it in her possession. And that study, you know, that is solid study. There's another one, Lester Brown at the Earth Policy Institute has found similar conclusions. He believes we can get 80% reduction of carbon by 2020 without nuclear, without fossil fuels, to go to the same kind of future. Scientific American cover story in November 2009 was another study done by some professors at Stanford and University of California at Davis. They said by 2030 we can produce all our power from the sun, the wind, and the waves. and they lay it out, and there's a technical report linked to that, you know, more popular story that was published in Scientific American. There's a physicist in the Green Party, the D.C. Statehood Green Party, and his son is an environmental professor who've come out with a mathematical model showing that 1% investment of our fossil fuels that we're using now in building a renewable energy system based on solar and its derivatives like wind and ground source heat pumps is all we need to get to a self-sustaining solar-based energy system. What? So there's a lot of studies out there. Look, renewables are as old as Homo erectus.
Right.
You know, our ancestors 1.5 million years ago who had brains two-thirds the size of us, they figured out how to start fires and burn that renewable resource called wood. And, you know, the technologies we're talking about today, like heat pumps, which are refrigerators, basically, to heat and cool our buildings using solar energy stored in the ground, that was invented in 1850. The fuel cell, you know, the hydrogen fuel cell, where you have hydrogen as a way of storing energy, combines with oxygen, water vapor comes out, that's your exhaust, it's clean, can fuel our transportation system or our homes, electric and create electricity. That was invented in 1830. So this is not new technology. Nuclear power, all you're doing is boiling water to turn a generator. It's like cutting a stick of butter with a chainsaw. You end up with a big mess. You know, in the case of nuclear power, it's radioactive waste and possibly accidents if you don't cut the butter right. When all you need is a dull butter knife to get that slice of butter, that's what renewables are. They're simple. They're small scale, so you can build them out gradually rather than putting all your eggs in the basket of a multi-billion dollar investment that can have technical problems. The only reason we do this is that there are certain powerful corporations make a lot of money.
Okay.
Once the rate base, the base rate on which utilities are paid where they're regulated is the percentage of the capital they invest. Nuclear power is the most capital intensive. That's why they want to build them. Then they can soak ratepayers for decades to come.
As I recall, the origin of this stuff was back in the Eisenhower era when they decided that they needed to have something to justify nuclear production in a peaceful way. So they decided that, hey, we'll build reactors to generate electricity and it'll be free.
It was called Atoms for Peace.
Right,
and actually, it contradicted the recommendations of the Paley Commission, which was set up by the Truman administration, to look at the problem of what are we going to do when we run out of oil? And they were worried about that because, you know, during World War II, there was a whole scramble for who would get to the Persian Gulf first, Hitler or the Allies. And so then they realized that's a limited resource, so what's the future going to be? The Paley Commission recommended solar in the early 1950s, and I think it was 1954 that the Truman Eisenhower administration decided, no, we're going to go nuclear. And part of it was the Atoms for Peace, the friendly atom. And I learned about it in my weekly reader as a, you know.
Oh, my goodness. I'd forgotten about those.
They were telling us nuclear power is cheap and clean. And,
right.
You know, these little animal, do you call them, anthropomorphic atoms, you know, cartoon characters.
Yes.
And I think it was a name for them. I can't remember it right now. And I accepted that until I read a book in 1970 in the lead up to the first Earth Day called The Perils of the Peaceful Atom. And that's when I learned about the radioactive waste problem and the potential for catastrophic accidents that, you know, at that time, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a meltdown could wipe out an area the size of Pennsylvania and make it uninhabitable for the end of time as far as humanity is concerned. Because these wastes, you know, plutonium is a half-life of hundreds of thousands of years, you know, longer than human civilization. So, you know, it's just the wrong thing to do as far as people's health and wealth is concerned.
Yeah. Well, we're coming up on the 20-minute limit here, so we're going to have to say goodbye, I guess, because you feel like, Teresa says you have to go to your next appointment. So I want to thank you, Howie, for being on the air with us, and I also want to thank Teresa for the enormous amount of work she's put into organizing this tour. And we hope to have a chance to talk to you again sometime. This has been Howie Hawkins, founder of the Clamshell Alliance back in 1976, that put a stop to the nuclear power cascade that was going on, and they've been put in abeyance. No new nuclear plants designed since then. We ended up at 103 nuclear reactors that were designed up until in the Nixon administration, and then it came to a halt. So
that's right. He wanted to build 1,000, and we defeated him on 897 of them.
Good for
you.
So
we have a very successful movement, and you know, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. And as we coined the phrase back then, no nukes.
Yeah. No nukes.
Absolutely, no more nukes. And okay. package up and bury the ones that we have now. Thank you so much. We hope to talk to you again sometime. And good luck on the rest of the tour.
Yes, okay, good bye. Luck, and thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I'm sorry that was so short. I really would like to talk to him more about where do we go next, because one tour, of course, is not likely to implement. Yeah. And, again, I, as I've said before on this show, I am a fan and avid follower of the folks of the Deep Green Resistance. And if you haven't read that book, I urge you to do it. But we need to be thinking about where we go when, you know, trying to talk to them, the powers that be, does not take us where we need to be, because we all need to become more active if we are going to save our planet. Yeah. And our, communities, with both from economic and environmental ecological disasters.
One of the things that I discovered in my research is that in 2010, the cost of nuclear power had grown to the point, and the cost of solar photovoltaic electricity had fallen to the point where they were equal. And then the cost of nuclear power is going up, and the cost of solar photovoltaic power is coming down. So it's time to stop fooling around with the nuclear stuff, because not only does it have all the nasty side effects of ugly waste and all the other dangers, but it costs more, and it will continue to cost more. And, of course, solar photovoltaic is absolutely zero carbon emissions.
To what do we attribute the cost of the photovoltaics going down?
Well, part of it, I'm sure, is improved technology. I can recall back when I was doing research, must have been on the order of 20 to 25 years ago, there was a design that we were experimenting with and basically simulating with computer models that had the promise of an inherent efficiency of converting 30% of solar light energy into electricity directly. I don't think it ever came to fruition when it came time to manufacture it.
When was that?
That was, like I say, about 25 years ago.
Okay, maybe right around the time of, let's see, 25 years ago. I am
85,
clearly
1985.
Yeah, I was thinking, wasn't that, you know, sort of Reagan-era U.S.?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Reagan really squelched any of the, steps toward.
Yeah, we managed to have some research going on in the background, and like I say, I don't think it ever went anywhere, or we'd have heard about it. But it was, according to the theoretical study, possible to be that efficient, and that's if they're able to approach that level of efficiency now, that certainly would explain it. Also, the manufacturing processes, as they ramp up, will have improving economies of scale, just like they claim for everything that you make. If you make enough of it, it'll be cheaper.
Yeah, we've got to stop thinking though about things like that in that way, because economies of scale is too intimately connected to the capitalist model that
right
has
and,
gotten us into this mess.
Yeah, too big to fail. I know.
Yeah,
if you could keep growing.
Right.
But, so let's see. Why don't we take a break now? And go through our underwriter, Internationalist Bookstore, and remind you that they are at 405 West Franklin Street here in Chapel Hill, an alternative bookstore and a community resource. I remember seeing... my mind empties out, except that I saw the name Internationalist Books on something that may be happening like on October 10th that I don't remember what it is, but I remember putting it down on my calendar.
Oh, good. Okay. So, sorry, I can't help you there.
So, anyway, we appreciate their assistance in keeping us and the other programs of WCOM on the air. This is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom Hour, sponsored by the Triangle WILPF. And that's the name of our website, Triangle WILPF, for Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, .org. And you can find that out there and keep up with our activities, at least to a certain extent. You can also find virtually all of the radio shows we've ever done archived so that you can browse around and listen. One of the things that I saw recently, because I was prompted by remembering it, is that there's Sami Al-Aryan's film about his... incarceration for being a terrorist. Was that what they thought he was, or something? Anyway, he was actually a journalist, and eventually he was let go. But there was a documentarian who made the film of his life, and we were one of the very first media outlets to interview the director and his son here back in April of 08. It's been a long time.
It has been a long time. I remember talking with them, interviewing them, but it's been a long time.
Right, and I actually found it back in the archive. That's what I remembered when I saw the name, and I went and looked in the archive, and it's there. So if you're interested in that, you can check it out. And this is WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro, 103.5 on your FM dial if you happen to be close enough to our transmitter, since it is LP, which stands for low power, and that's no joke.
It's true. But can also stream us.
Yes, you can stream us by going to the station's website, wcomfm.org, and click on the button that says Listen Live, and you can. Whatever's on the air at the moment streams out over the internets, so that you can hook into one of those tubes and listen to us.
And I'd like to announce this is Mental Illness Awareness Week. Club Nova, right here in Carrboro, is observing Mental Illness Awareness Week with some events October 6th, 7th, and 8th. The public's invited to join Club Nova as they host their third annual celebration of Mental Illness Awareness Week. Thursday, October 6th, that's tomorrow, 4 p.m. to 8 p.m., there's a spaghetti dinner for $5 and a candlelight vigil. The vigil begins at 7:15 to honor and remember loved ones and friends with mental illness. Friday, October 7th, from noon to 2 p.m., there's a tea room with a light lunch and dessert. Again, it's $5 donation. Saturday, October 8th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., there's a free community cookout that's hosted by Club Nova and the Carrboro Police Department. And each day's events include live music from local artists, an art exhibit of the works of members, and there are some talented artists there, as well as a silent auction. The silent auction will begin tomorrow, Thursday, October 6th at 10 a.m., and it will conclude 4 p.m. on Saturday, October 8th. Club Nova offers opportunities for recovery through education, employment, friendship, and hope. And tours of the clubhouse are available daily from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Again, the public's invited. That's Club Nova, 103D West Main Street in Carrboro. Then there are some other things coming up. The Rock for Reproductive Rights, October 15th at 8 p.m. This is sponsored by International Reproductive Health and Rights Organization, www.ipas.org. And Toshi Reagan and Big Lovely will headline the Rock for Reproductive Rights Benefit Concert on Saturday, October 15th, 8 p.m. at Motorco in Durham. And Toshi's music spans rock, blues, R&B, country, folk, spirituals, and funk. And she has played with Elvis Costello, Annie DeFranco, Dar Williams, Liz Wright, and with her mother, Sweet Honey, in the Rock co-founder, Bernice Johnson Reagan. So Durham's Humble Tripe will open. The concert will benefit IPAS, an International Reproductive Health and Rights Organization. And for more information about the organization and the concert, go to www.ipas.org. And finally, there is also on the 15th, NC Friends of Safe Passage. They will hold their second annual 5K walk and race fundraiser in Southern Village starting at 9 a.m. The event supports Safe Passage in Guatemala City, which cares for 550 children and their families who live around the city's garbage dump. They help provide nutrition, education, health care, and hope for those folks who live in extreme poverty. There are lots of activities for the whole family, including a bounce house, face painting, a mini race, music, prizes, and crafts. To register, go to sportoften.com. That's sportoften.com. Again, that's Saturday, October 15th in Southern Village, 9 a.m., the Safe Passage Fundraiser and 5K Race.
Oh, I was going to ask what a mini race is. Obviously,
less than 5K, got to be.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. It's either very short or the contestants are very short, one or the other.
Maybe both. Maybe it's just right around, I don't know, around the block. I don't know. I wish they would explain a little more. One more thing, October 14th through the 16th, the Orange County Public Library is having a book sale. It's the Friends of the Orange County Public Library. And it is at the main library on West Margaret Lane in Hillsboro. The Friends of the Orange County Public Library is sale is coming up. This is written. Sorry, guys. I'm sorry. I'm reading something that's written, and it's written rather badly. Okay. The sale will include hardcover books, $1 each, paperbacks for 50 cents each, and DVDs, $1 each. On Friday the 14th, the members-only preview sale takes place from 4 to 6 p.m., and it's limited to Friends members only. But you can become a member at the door if you want to go on Friday. On Saturday the 15th, the sale will be open to the public from 9 to 5. And on Sunday is bag day. You fill a bag of books for just $4, and bags will be provided, and the sale will be open to the public from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. So I think that's it. And this is a WCOM fundraiser, Acoustic Fest, and that's the Thursday, October 13th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Cave right here on West Franklin Street in Carrboro. Wait a moment. The West Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. Featured will be Tim Stambaugh, Birds and Arrows, Harmonica Bob, and Near Blind James. So that's Acoustic Fest, Thursday, October 13th, 7 to 10 p.m. Come out to the Cave in Chapel Hill to raise money for WCOM, our all-volunteer community radio station. No one here is paid. We are all volunteers, but we still have to pay the bills, rent and utilities, as well as internet streaming and insurance and equipment upkeep and the phones and license fees, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We pay fees for things like Free Speech Radio and Democracy Now! We don't do tote bags or coffee mugs or trips, but what you get in return for your contribution is access to some of the best local radio, where friends and neighbors keep you company any time of the day or night. We're a nonprofit organization. All donations are tax deductible. You can go right now to WCOMFM.org, click on the Donate Now button, and you can make a secure donation. If you donate just $10 a month, trust me, I've been doing this for a while now, $10 a month, and you really don't miss it. $10 a month on your credit card gets you membership in the Less Than a Latte Club, and you'll score a members-only bumper sticker and recognition on the WCOM website. You can write a check for whatever you can afford and send it to WCOM. Thanks for supporting your voice in the community. WCOM is a wonderful resource, and we're here only through your help and the generosity and energy of our volunteers. So now we're back to, I guess we've still got a while.
Yeah,
we still got some time. So we're back. We were talking about the No Nukes Tour, which Dick's been a part of organizing. So Dick, you want to talk a little bit more? Do you want to say, because you gave quite an interesting and eloquent presentation last night.
Well, I'm trying to think what we haven't already covered. I did mention the fact that nuclear power is more expensive than solar and rising, and it's going to be more expensive than almost anything else. Some of the other things that affect whether or not nuclear power is desirable is the consideration of the entire nuclear fuel cycle. Much of the source of the raw materials for nuclear fuel, the uranium ore, a lot of it seems to appear, strangely enough, on lands belonging to First Nations, either in this country or in Canada or in Australia. And so the process of getting the raw materials to make uranium fuel rods and so on involves displacing or otherwise inconveniencing First Nations, such as, I believe it's the Navajo out west.
Wow.
But the only proper way to treat uranium, as far as they're concerned, is to leave it in the ground, because it takes an enormous amount of ore to create a significant amount of usable uranium fuel. So, unfortunately, what's left over gets dumped back on the land, exposed to the elements, and still radioactive. It's just not radioactive with the stuff that they need to make nuclear fuel with. Then they
but it's still sufficient to be
hazardous,
extremely hazardous,
toxic
to life.
Yeah, a lot of it is stuff that, for example, radon gas is highly toxic, even though it's a rarefied gas. I should say a rare gas. When you ingest it into your lungs, it disintegrates into real nasty particles, and because it's in your lungs already, it plops it right into your tissues, and is therefore very, very dangerous. And That kind of thing is true of the other radioactive species that are not recovered. Then after it's been reduced somewhat, it has to go to these fancy enrichment plants in order to bring it to a highly enriched state, which means that it takes enormous amounts of power to do that. And, of course, a lot of that is generated either by using hydropower, which is then takes away from using hydropower, which is virtually pollution-free, into creating the nuclear fuel, or by hooking them up to a nuclear power plant, perhaps, in order to be able to refine the ore down to a concentration where it's usable in a nuclear reactor. Then you have to move it to the reactor and load it into the reactor and contain it in the reactor and deal with the radiation that goes into the water that cools the reactor. And if the water leaks, then you have to deal with the radioactive water running around loose. And it goes on. And then, of course, when you're finished and the fuel rods are spent, you either store them or you reprocess them. And even if you reprocess them, only part of the radiation that's left is useful. And again, you've got leftover radioactivity. And in this case, because it comes out of spent fuel rods, it's really highly concentrated. And you have to store it somewhere. And unfortunately, one of the dangers of storing it somewhere is that, you know, the ever-present fear that they try to throw at us these days, terrorists breaking in and grabbing some and using it in a dirty bomb or whatever. So all these things don't happen if you don't use nuclear fuel to start with. And so that's, you know, just considering the fuel cycle, without the other possibilities of real disasters like Fukushima or Chernobyl.
And there is a growing body of evidence that we do have the resources and capability to provide energy without resorting to nuclear. We can reduce our CO2 emissions, but we can also generate energy, all of our energy needs, and we can go to zero CO2 economy without nuclear power.
It's been actually studied and demonstrated conclusively that at least in North Carolina, which seems to be a relatively rich natural source environment, that we can create all the energy needed in North Carolina from renewable resources, solar, water, hydropower, wave power, wind power. You combine all those things and distribute it around the state equitably. We don't need anything else. Don't need to burn any coal. Don't need to frack any natural gas. We don't need to have any nuclear fuel running around the place and emitting radiation. So, and by the way, there's also a fair amount of radiation that comes from coal. Not many people know that, but that is, in fact, the case. In addition to all of the nasty stuff like mercury and cadmium and whatever kinds of heavy metals, there's also radiation that's stored in coal and comes loose when you burn it.
Good. Great. Wonderful.
Just thought you'd want to know.
Yes, absolutely. I need more things to...
More things to worry about?
Yes.
I'll do what I can.
Good. All right. So the use of highly efficient energy technologies and building design are generally, and these are technologies that are already generally available, and those can ease the transition to a zero CO2 economy and reduce its cost. a 2% annual increase in efficiency per unit of GDP relative to recent trends results in a 1% decline in energy use per year while providing 3% GDP annual growth, well within the capacity of available technological performance. That comes from that report, Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free, a roadmap for U.S. energy policy. Look it up. I urge you to look it up.
Right, and that's from, what, 4 years ago?
That's from 4 years ago.
So
go to www.ieer.org. That's Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. www.ieer.org/carbon-free.
And it's probably...
great and readable.
It's probably even better... now that we've had more time to develop the technologies that that will allow us to be carbon-free and nuclear-free.
Well, I know there are developments. People are working on it. I don't know how far. There hasn't been that much funding for these technologies in recent years, though. You know, the Bush administration was a friend of the energy, the extant energy industries.
Yes, they were renewable hostile.
Yes, we were renewable hostile. Okay. Biofuels. Now, there's a lot of argument about biofuels, I know, and we need to get somebody in here to talk about biofuels one day. But the report says that they can be crucial to the transition to a zero CO2 economy without any serious environmental side effects. Or alternatively, they can produce they could produce considerable collateral damage or even be harmful to the environment and increase greenhouse gas emissions, depending on the policies we choose and the incentives that are provided and research and development. So, you know, it all depends on us, folks, and there's a great list of 12 recommendations, policy recommendations in this report, too, that seem eminently reasonable and sensible. So I don't know why we don't do it. I do know why. It's money.
Yeah.
Money going to those at the top, and those at the top prefer to maintain the status quo and not do anything that might...
rock their boat.
Yeah, rock their boat. That's right. But we're going to have to do it. We're going to have to. We don't have much choice left. We have got some serious threats facing us environmentally and economically, and we just need to wake up and get the will to make the changes we need to do.
Right. We have the knowledge. We have the technology. We need the will to use them.
The will. Mm-hmm. Getting the political will. I am... agonized over that. How do we do that? You know what? Maybe we don't. I mean, one of the things I really, again, the more I've talked, I've traveled, I've been in Wisconsin, I've been in Texas, in recent weeks, and talking with people, I find myself always in conversations with somebody on a plane or, you know, just at a, you know, over dinner or over coffee someplace, just they'll notice what I'm reading or I'll notice what they're reading and we get into a chat. And I've spoken with people who are both see things the way I do and don't. But it is quite clear that we need to make some changes. Everybody seems to agree on that. The direction those changes carry us is still in dispute. But I'm coming down on the side that we are going to have to, if we cannot find the will and create the critical mass that we need to make these changes in order to protect our environment and our human, all resources, you know, animal, mineral, vegetable, from the exploitation that our culture seems to thrive on, we're going to have to take some serious actions, and both above ground, perhaps, and underground. And we need to develop strategies that work and ways to disrupt and to actually get in the way. If they're going to come and build, you know, try to build a plant, we got to figure out how to stop it, doing whatever we need to do.
Yeah, one of the things that is mentioned in Deep Green Resistance, among other things, among other places, is the fact that every day 200 species go extinct.
Extinct.
And that means they disappear forever.
Mm-hmm.
They're not all dodo birds, but they are all individual species that are unique forms of life,
Yeah. And
they're part of the web of life, and if we destroy enough of them, there won't be anything to support us. And it also seems to me that at some level, they have their own reason to call on us to preserve their existence.
Yeah, except that I really have found, I mean, I'm trying not to be the voice of doom, but it disturbs me just how many people in this country don't, if it doesn't touch them immediately, they don't really care about it, you know? Or even if they sort of care, they don't have the time or energy to worry about it. They've got already too much to worry about. So it's not real to them that 200 species, you know? They don't know they're dying. They don't know what these species are most of the time. I don't know,
right?
You know, what these species are, right? We don't see it. It's not part of our immediate experience. And, you know, you can care a great deal, but somehow it has to become real to people, you know, in a very immediate way that this matters to them. But what they get in the media is, you know, somehow big industry, technology, the military-industrial complex, Wall Street will solve it all if we just stand back, give them all our money, and, you know, let
right.
them do what they want with it,
mm-hmm.
you know? But, folks, that ain't happening. If you've
well,
been paying attention lately, Occupy Wall Street is a great movement. I love
yes.
it.
I was watching that some of that this afternoon because both Tamron Hall and Dylan Radigan, who are broadcasters on MSNBC, were at Occupy Wall Street. They actually
really?
Went down there and they not only were they both there, but they were actually talking to each other about the situation. And it's interesting.
What were they saying?
That they were very much in favor of it, and they don't take any guff about, well, they don't have a program. Of course they don't. They're trying to put it together. That's what their General Assembly is all about, that they have every evening. So they're putting together a program as they go. They've discovered
who
that things
that?
Are
you're
wrong.
Talking about the Occupy Wall Street folks and
yes.
not Radigan. And,
no,
oh,
not
okay.
Radigan, but he yeah. was saying he was observing that this is what they're doing and was very positive about it. He said,
oh, good.
It's the way to go about it. You have to identify the problem, and then you have everybody who sees the problem working on solving it instead of just a few people
right.
Dumping out a rack of ideas, which you can either choose to accept a few of or accept all or none, whatever. But they're actually working as a group, and they're growing.
That's great.
And Dylan Radigan is, to me, is an amazing guy because every once in a while he'll get his teeth into something, and he will just like a terrier, he'll hold on and shake it, and he really, he's one of the best ranters I've ever seen. But he doesn't do it all the time, of course, because it depends. And it seems to me that, you know, his field is sort of management and economics. And so he gets going on some of this stuff, particularly like the too big to fail banks and all that kind of thing. So, you know, like I say, he doesn't get into that mood all the time. But when he does, he's just really, I think he's more outspoken and more of a coherent ranter than Keith Olbermann sometimes.
Ah.
To use another MSNBC, well, former MSNBC former, personality yes. who's now on Current. Yeah. So, and to see the fact that they had two of their afternoon anchors down there where the action is, that shows that the whole thing's beginning to gain traction. And that and the fact that there are 200 and some offshoot sympathetic occupations going on around the country today.
Yes.
In addition to the one in Wall Street that started.
Over the weekend, there was one in Durham and one in Raleigh. So,
right.
That's good.
And there will be more. Tomorrow, the one in D.C. starts, which is
yes.
different. But
I wish I could go. But
yeah, it was interesting that to two of the people who started it, one of them being Margaret Flowers. I can't remember the guy's name, but they started the October 6th, or what it's called properly is October 2011 movement. Started it about 6 months ago, and they basically had the same sort of idea as what turned out to happen in Occupy Wall Street, but of course it was scheduled for D.C., and they were just amazed to see something else take root, following basically the model that they had in mind. So we'll see how it comes out tomorrow.
If you have any opportunity to go to D.C. or to Wall Street, I urge you to do it. I would be there in a heartbeat if I could, but I have responsibilities here that I cannot renege on, so I can't go until later in the month. I am planning on going in October 29th, which is the coffee party thing. I am, if I can't make it up earlier than that, I'm going to go.
Yeah.
God help me, I'm please. I've been a little busy recently, yeah. But I'd love to go.
Tell us a little bit about the coffee. Well, we are almost out of time.
We're almost out, yeah.
Yeah.
Got,
so,
yeah,
but I
you can check
that
out the coffee
like,
party.
Yeah, I understand there's like 4 million members that kind of assembled themselves.
Yeah,
it
really
party.
Went viral.
And you hear a lot about the so-called tea party, mm-hmm. but the coffee party seems to me to be, more, like you said, more viral and probably larger than the tea party really is.
Yeah, I don't know how large the Tea Party is. I mean,
well, of course,
I know
there's a whole lot of branches and offshoots. And
yeah, and I know it's got.
Subsets.
I mean, it's basically a pet of the Koch brothers.
Right.
You know, they funded it and started it to make it look like grassroots.
Yeah. Well, let's begin to wrap up today. This is Dick Paddock, co-host and Knob Twiddler for. WIMS International League for Peace and Freedom here on the Wake Up Call, Connecting the Dots, and I hope we connected a few for you today. Tana, you want to sign
off? Thank you, Dick. And this is Tana Hartman, and I'll see you around.
Take care. Good luck to you all.